Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by Mobius Strip Press. I am G.R. Mobley. If you go to my site, reclaimingtherepublic.org, you will have access to my content and support documents and links. This is an educational grassroots program leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. As you've already heard, a very good conversation with Dr. Vile. That conversation did continue, as you could tell. But before we move forward in haste to hear the rest of that conversation, this show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org, as well as 1798Part2.org and RepublicReview.org. You are listening to the only show that offers you the constitutional solution in getting the federal government into the framework of the Constitution. I do not shy from having conversations with constitutional scholars and leaders in thought. I will tell you this as well, that when you listen to the rest of this conversation, I try to get the doctor to commit to, you know, whether he's going to, you know, his feelings on Republic Review, as well as, you know, whether he's going to support it or not. And it's unfortunate. I honestly believe that there's lots of people that do not see beyond the ramifications of shutting down the federal government in tyrannical roles. I truly believe that education and what he's offering, because there's very few colleges out there that actually teach the Constitution. I honestly think that his classes and what he offers in political science will be warmly welcomed, especially after we get the federal government out of education. People are going to want to know the details and want to know more of this. But this is an interesting conversation, as you can tell, and so it's one that must go on. I will also tell you that there's just so much evidence that supports the concept of Republic Review within the ratification debates, which is why I emphasize and focus and provide you citations out of the ratification debates, because that is exactly how the framers understood. And Madison was the one to say, we are supposed to interpret the Constitution as it was interpreted when they accepted the Constitution. In other words, on the terms that they agreed to. That's it. That's it right there, folks. As you can tell, we're already at that break. When we come back, we will have more with the good doctor. So please stay tuned, and we'll be right back after this. I've been on the radio for a couple of years, and for over a decade, I have been providing content to help patriots understand what has to be done if we're going to save our Constitution and our Republic. Not one academic has been able to refute my argument for Republic Review, and even most conservative entertainers will not support Republic Review due to self-interest reasons. If you have not read my bullet point descriptions and executive summaries, you need to, so that you can understand what we all need to do. I am trying to give patriots the necessary knowledge to take back our Constitution and Republic. Go to ReclaimingTheRepublic.org so you can read my bullet points and view the Republic Review flowchart. You can even order my executive summaries, books, and other content to understand the simplicity of what we have to do. This way, you will know what, why, and how to support the reclaiming of our Republic. Again, please take a look at my content on ReclaimingTheRepublic.org so you can become a part of the solution. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
Okay, folks, we are back with Dr. Vial. Thank you for holding on. And you were speaking of domestic tranquility, but before you get into finishing your thought, I know you have a JD, so I know you're really good at, you know, setting up arguments and so forth, but
I'm going to stop you there because I have a PhD. I have not been tainted with a law degree.
Oh, I thought you had a JD from.
No, I do most of my writing in the law, but I had a subfield in political science that dealt with judicial process and constitutional law, but I don't have a JD.
Oh, okay.
So you'll have to attribute my argumentativeness to either my marital situation or my training in debate and mock trial. I'm not sure.
And that's true. You've got extensive.
I was a debater in college, and I coached mock trial here for 25 years, and I've had some good success with it.
But before you get back into that, I wanted to circle back real quick before I lose my train of thought.
Sure.
That you basically asserted that the Constitution has gone through three shifts, and these are shifts of paradigms. They're not shifts of contract, because the 14th Amendment may have broadened the application of privileges, immunities, and what some people call due process and those types of things. But it didn't open up any new doors in creating the federal government. In other words, they basically, from that point forward, if I remember correctly, started using statutes and regulations to moving things the way they wanted and creating changes to the Electoral College and so forth. That's when they started using statutes and or regulations instead of following the precedents that they went out the gate with in amending the Constitution.
Well, you had four amendments, of course, during the Progressive Era.
Absolutely. But those amendments, again, are only applicable to the changes that they made, whether that be the 17th Amendment or the 16th Amendment. It didn't basically say, oh, and by the way, down the road, we're going to be able to grant ourselves any other powers without having to follow the Article 5 process.
Right. And again, the ones that I mentioned the other main one that I mentioned is the New Deal, and that is the most subject to what you're saying here. There was literally, unless it would be that, lame duck. Basically, it left no constitutional imprint that sort of reflected the changes in the scope of governmental activity.
I mean, right.
You know, the ABCs of all the governmental programs that were introduced, you know, have perpetuated themselves without a constitutional amending base.
Okay, so
let me
throw this paradigm of history, because I think you'll agree with me that the ratification debates were pretty much obscured. I mean, as we talked before, that they came out, I think, in the 1840s. So we today, now that we actually have access to them because of the beauty of the internet, it's not like those things were ever published, put in every library, put in every state, and so forth. They were kind of left in obscurity. And so the understanding of what was really defined as the limitations of the Constitution was obscured for such a long time that during the Progressive Era and the New Deal and so forth, we had to rely upon these great minds that have been building case law, constitutional law, precedents, and so forth. And I'll just use the word, we were duped. We were duped from the very beginning with some of the arguments that Marshall made and so forth. And so I assert that now that we have the true fidelity, it's kind of like if I bought a, you know, one of these mind game pictures that out of a garage sale, and right. I said, you know, I just want to buy this for the frame, and I pay the kid $5, and I take it home, and I, you know, take the frame off, and lo and behold, behind this is a classic work of art that was family owned, and it was stolen, you know, 100 and some years sure. ago, and all of a sudden I say, hey, I've got this, and it's worth a lot of money. Well, actually, I don't have it. It still belongs to somebody else because that is a possession. That's property. And just like the powers, roles, and responsibilities were delineated, and as Nichols said in the ratification debates of Virginia, that when we only delegate a certain amount of property, because I think he talked about 1,000 acres, and if I gave 500 acres to the federal government or we delegate these powers, do I have to do a new deed on the power or the state or the property that I still possess? And I'm paraphrasing, of course, but he says,
right.
No, I don't have to because I still own that. And so that right. these roles, responsibilities were property of the states, and the federal government duped us. And I'm taking a lot of latitude here.
I guess the qualification I would add is that in many ways, first, the chronology is not quite right, but close. I mean, We got Madison's notes of the convention at about 1840.
Right.
Many of the debates within the states were published in the papers contemporaneously. They are now being collected in a 30-40 volume set done by University of Wisconsin.
Yeah.
A great mm-hmm. work. But in some sense, I'd almost have to say that we were. I mean, I don't know that I'd use the word deuce, but we have been willing participants in this. We have. For better or worse, and I'm certainly, you know, I'm familiar with the arguments and not insensitive to those that say we've gone too far, but we have faced crises in our history where we have been willing to, I don't know, look the other way when it comes to explicit constitutional foundations for them and looked at the particular case at hand. And, you know, you see this, I'm finishing a book right now on disaster relief in the United States. And early in our history, we had intense debates over, you know, whether it was proper for Congress to appropriate any money for anybody that, you know, that was a particular area or a particular place as opposed to something that applied overall. And over time, we have had less such arguments, and the arguments tend to be more about how much aid shall we give, and what conditions shall we put with it, and, you know, is the aid that we're giving likely, as in the case of some of these hurricane insurance, is it likely to lead to future, you know, disasters, you know, down the road?
Right. Right. But I guess what I'm saying, and let me change the gears a little bit, and let's look at this as, let's say we move forward. Let's say I actually have this charisma, this power of influence that I can actually get a state, South Dakota, North Dakota, if you're listening, Wyoming, you know, a state that is a true bastion of conservative thought and recognizes that the Constitution is way out of line. And they actually come to the, you know, the realization or agree with me that they do have the power to audit the Constitution and to step up and say, federal government, we never gave you these things. We never, through the Article 5 process, you were running us into ruin and so forth. So they move forward with this audit and they make the appeal. And I assert that what Jefferson and Madison did with the resolutions in their appeal, because clearly they didn't try to amend the Constitution to, you know, to redo or undo the sedition acts. They appealed to the other states to say, this is unconstitutional. You're going to let this actually happen? And and so they were trying to coalesce the states instead of convening
an
Article 5.
And what happened, of course, there is they couldn't get any other states to go along with them. Now, what was more successful is they did win the election of 1800.
Right.
And they began a more, you know, restrictive view of the powers of the national government.
Sure.
But they never actually got any other states to go along with the Virginia and Kentucky resolution.
Right. And what happened was they let the genie out of the bottle on nullification. But what my point is let's say I get, and I believe the sentiment in these conservative states, these strong, hard red states, flyover states, let's call them. But I believe the sentiment is such that when they wake up and they realize that they still possess the authority and the power of the Constitution, I don't think it's going to be just one or two states. I believe that we're probably, how many states challenge just Obamacare? And how many states are challenging the fact that, you know, this federal government is in spend out of control danger of us going into, you know, a real financial crisis and what have you. So if all of a sudden I have 15, 20, 30 states, maybe even 34 states that say we want to audit this Constitution, what do you believe is, you know, going to happen? And again, I've said this before, I'm not looking for an Article 5 or making any changes. I'm just trying to get back to enforcement or forcing the federal government to say, okay, we believe we need to do these things, and here's amendments to do them. We're going to get back into following this thing. And to me, I'd be very happy.
Yeah, and I mean, you had a little bit of this in to go back to the FDR.
But let me give you a couple of minutes. We're going to go to break here, and so I want you to ruminate in answering that, and the floor will be yours, sir. As I'm expecting to hear some music coming up, and actually there it is. See, I'm clairvoyant on time maybe, but anyway. Doctors, please stay tuned, folks. We're going to be right back, and the doctor will be able to answer this perpetuating problem that I think we have. Thank you very much, and stay tuned.
To become a citizen, one must take an oath to support and defend the Constitution. Those of us who are naturally born citizens are obligated and duty-bound to fulfill the same oath, even though we're not required to take it, because it is implied upon us at birth. This is why I cannot emphasize enough the importance in supporting businesses who are supporting our Constitution. We have to stop supporting businesses that have chosen to hide behind political correctness, and obviously we must stop supporting progressive businesses who are working to undermine our republic and our Constitution. Do not let businesses or organizations convince you that they are supporting the Constitution by supporting protests for social justice. By definition, social justice is the distribution of wealth, opportunities, and privileges within a society. In other words, they're calling for socialism, which is incompatible with individual liberty and individual sovereignty and our Constitution. With that, please consider supporting businesses who advertise on this show and this radio station.
Okay, and thank you for staying tuned, folks. We still have the good doctor. So, Professor, now that you've had time, what do you believe is going to happen if these states feel like they're so disenfranchised and they feel like there's no other resolve but to step up and audit the Constitution? The floor is yours, sir.
You know, I guess if I had a choice, I would say it would be better to try to do an Article 5 convention. If you know what you wish to change the Constitution, and you have some proposals, put them out there. Try to get them discussed. What I think is, I think the problem with the audit is I think that there are shortcuts. I think it's much more likely that people are going to, you know, they're going to look to the next election, either at the state level or the national level, and say, you know, well, the last bums we elected, they didn't do it, but this group is going to. And for every person that you think, you know, that thinks that the Constitution has gone too far, you're probably going to have another who thinks that the government ought to be doing more, whether it's in health care or in regard to immigration control or disaster relief or whatever. So, I would encourage anybody who wants to get encouraged in involved in government to do this, but I just... if we haven't done an audit like this after 200 and some years, it seems unlikely that we would do it now.
And the reason is we're actually gaining access to documents that have been, like I said, obscured because of technology. The only way you could have really read the ratification debates is possibly going back to the states and going through their archives of the newspapers or what have you. And I would just find it very...
Well, I can put a perspective on it that's interesting. It's not certainly definitive.
And as you do, I will give you the next problem coming down the pike when you're done.
Okay. One of the interesting things about James Madison, who was, you know, is often called the father of the Constitution,
yep.
Probably had as much to do with it as anyone, is he did not want his papers published during his lifetime, because he did not think that that was the appropriate way to interpret the Constitution. He thought he thought that whatever was decided in debate, the primary thing we ought to be doing is looking at what do the words actually say, and what did they, you know, probably with a caveat, what did they mean at the time that they were written?
Sure, and I absolutely
and so
agree with that.
I'm not sure, you know, I think he might say as valuable to historians and political scientists as these documents are, that train has sort of left the station. We, you know, by 1840, we had already pretty much established what principles of constitutional construction were going to be, and he wasn't always satisfied with them, but it was like he thought that was a better way than going back and reading, I'll say, musty documents. I don't know if they're musty or not. They're not to me, because I love them. But
yeah.
Anyway.
But so I absolutely agree with Madison's position, because it infuriates me when people try to bring up some of Madison's artistic license or latitudes that he took in asserting his biases in his notes on the convention. It's not so... What I believe is relative.
I have to defend a fellow Virginian here.
Oh, okay.
I'm familiar with those criticisms, and I don't think they're particularly valid. But that's another story for another day.
No, if I was arguing in the Supreme Court on this case over the auditing and so forth, when you get into things that happen in a vacuum, whether it's a journal or so forth, it's different than when it actually happens as an official document. A good example of that is the thank you response back to the Danbury Baptist by Thomas Jefferson, and that little line of the separation of church and state,
right,
that was never intended to be an official document. But the veto message back to Congress was an official document. The ratification debates and what was said on that floor was in official capacity. So it's nice to have these little, you know, insights of Madison, Jefferson, and these letters,
sure,
back and forth. But to me, they hold nothing other than opinion or hearsay. And the only thing we really have to go on is what did they actually do? And so those resolutions,
right,
of Kentucky and Virginia are hard, tangible things that they actually stood up and said, you're violating the Constitution, you can't do this. And what they said in an official capacity, to me, holds water.
Sure.
And there's lots of other really good supporting documents that I, you know, would agree with my argument, but I have to leave those on the table and say, you know, that wasn't in an official capacity. That was done in a vacuum.
Yeah, no, I'm working on a book right now on the Declaration of Independence, and there are all kinds of people who say, well, Jefferson couldn't really have meant a creator God because Jefferson was a deist or this or that. Well, he was writing a public document. And it doesn't particularly matter what Mr. Jefferson
believed, right,
confided to friends. It's what did he say in the document?
Right, right. And that's true, because in his confidential letters to James, or not James, but to John Adams, he basically, you know, bore his soul in his religious beliefs. And it's interesting how people ignore those things and call him a deist or what have you. But
sure,
that all aside, you're right. Those are personal things. And, you know, I actually wrote about this in my first book about Jefferson's religious views. I know you've possibly skimmed over. You may want to read it again.
Yes, it is.
Because
okay.
He was really moved by a book that was written by Sir Isaac Newton. It was
right.
The observations on the revelations of Daniel and the apocalypse.
Yes.
And so that book really had a huge impact on his religious views after that, because here's Sir Isaac Newton, a guy he absolutely respected, saying that he didn't believe any of the true churches existed, and he was committing heresy by writing that book.
He was. There's a recent book on Newton that just came out, and he was definitely, I mean, he believed deeply in Scripture, but he definitely had heretical views by comparison to the established church.
And of course, at that point in time,
Bacon, Locke, and Newton were the three people that Jefferson said you thought were the most important in world history.
Right. Yes. And they were challenging the church's authority of coronation and so forth. But here
yes.
we go.
Divine down, right.
We've definitely gone down another tangent and rat hole.
Well, that's what happens when you talk to a professor.
Well, thank you very much for taking the time. But going back to this, what happens, you know, and I know you've probably prefer the process, but to me the audit draws a line and says you can't do this, because down the pike they're going to create a department of babysitting. It's going to branch out of the health and human services department, because Hillary's already talked about this. It's already been floated that the state wants to basically start assigning a worker for when a woman finally chooses to go to term with a pregnancy, then that woman is going to be assigned a social worker, and then it's not just going to delivering the child, but she actually, if you've read her book, It Takes a Village, she wants the state involved to ensure that the child does not get introduced into dogma, you know, from religious
right.
dogma and so forth in the home. In other words, they're going to start mandating that you can't teach your kids religion and some of these things that, you know, are against what secularism they're ramming down our throats.
Well, there, I think we're protected adequately by the First Amendment, but after the last several years, I'm not so sure of anything anymore.
I believe that the Constitution, because it's a contract, we're protected. And if we draw the line and stand up and say you cannot do it without our permission, it makes it a much harder. And that's what Madison knew. The electorate needed to be protected from themselves, because they would instantly walk down this path of, oh, we need to be fed, feed us now. And then they would surrender something to do that. And
sure.
he knew that the electorate, he didn't say nice things about them, but he really was Wade, I believe.
That was an age where you could tell the truth without getting electorally defeated.
Yes.
Now we seem to have to pander.
Yes, it could be in Twitter sphere pretty quickly. And
yes, it could.
And so the big thing to me, and I know we're going to be coming up on a hard break, but the big thing to me is that they did create a system, because it was a hard, fast document that I believe that was the divine wisdom that, you know, they recognized, because all the framers asserted that they were inspired by the divine hand of providence, so much so that the very first thing that they did was they demanded, or they basically requested, that Washington make a proclamation of Thanksgiving that you're aware of. And I think that was an absolute recognition that they felt that this was a much greater thing than they could have ever have come up with. And by giving...
And that's where their deism actually doesn't seem very consistent. This is particularly true, by the way, of Benjamin Franklin, who usually sort of, you know, God's a creator and that's it, but he does at different times. And Washington certainly, you know, at different times attributes to providence, you know, what I guess was pretty extraordinary. You know, we forget how extraordinary it was, basically, to achieve independence of what was the world's, you know, greatest colonial power at the time.
Here's the interesting thing, Doctor, Professor. We're actually at the end of the show, so this is our third segment. And if you would please stay on, I want to record so that we can actually extend this into another show, because it's worth it to me, if you got
okay.
the time, if that's
sure.
okay. Thank you so much, folks. Stay tuned. We'll be back next week, and hopefully we'll have the doctor in these next segments. Have a good one, and God bless.
Reclaiming the Republic is more than an educational radio show. My intent is to also work with you and local leadership to promote matters of the Constitution and self-governance. This way we can all promote constitutional awareness within our communities and with our elected officials and public leaders. If you love liberty and sovereignty and recognize the federal tyranny that is threatening our lives, then we are asking for your help. And here are a few ways you can help. Spread the word about this radio show, Reclaiming the Republic. It is the only radio show in the world asserting a constitutional solution to federal overreach. Download and share our podcast and content. Read, like, follow, and share our Moby Strip Press and Reclaiming the Republic pages on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter at Moby Strip News. Get informed about local groups in the area and get involved. Most importantly, become a constitutional warrior with your local leaders and demand that they begin applying constitutional tests to what they are doing and who they are supporting. Thank you. To set the record straight, Republic Review is neither an Article 5 convention nor a convention of states. In accordance with Article 5 of the Constitution, this convention requires 2/3 of the states to apply to Congress to convene a convention with the intent to amend the Constitution. This convention is unable to solve our real problem, which is non-compliance to the Constitution, and would be dangerous to convene at this time. In contrast, Republic Review is the process of the states exerting its constitutional authority over the Constitution. An audit does not require an application to Congress. This authority is inherent to principal stakeholders of a contract. Why do we need Republic Review? Because this is the only way the states can deal with the federal encroachments into roles, responsibilities, and powers that belong to the states. To learn more about Republic Review, please go to reclaimingtherepublic.org to read my content and my model on the audit and Republic Review process. Okay, so we are back for another segment, and I've actually held over Dr. John R. Vile from Middle Tennessee University from our previous three segments because we've just been going down all of these discussions, rabbit holes, whatever you want to call them, tangents, and we're still trying to get, I think, the further light and knowledge and insights from the good professor on, you know, maybe the positive thing of drawing the line and saying you can't just continue to do this and drift and allow the electorate and popular opinion. You have to start abiding by this or this thing has no weight anymore. So anyway, back to you, Doctor.
Okay. Traditionally, I think part of the problem we have is traditionally we've relied on the judiciary for, you know, sort of holding the line. And, you know, as we've discussed, you know, and in the area of civil rights and civil liberties, certainly they have expanded, you know, the oversight of the national government on the part of the 14th Amendment. They came very close when it came to Obamacare. If you remember, we've had, two or three major decisions, and each one of them has been if I recall correctly, a 5-4 majority. Very tenuous majority, and one, you know, going so far as to split the difference between the taxing and spending clause and the commerce clause.
Right. Correct. And if we continue to rely on the judiciary, then we can continue to actually leave the door of judicial activism alive and well. And my assertion, or the whole reason I'm going down this, and the reason this is a life passion for me, is that I believe we've got to close that down, that the states have to say, no, there's nowhere in here that the Supreme Court was given the authority to amend the Constitution and make new things constitutional. They were limited to the jurisdiction of the Constitution, and they shouldn't be able to reach into issues such as marriage, such as abortion, and all of the health care, and all of these other things. Had they held that line, they would never have been able to, and I understand that they were threatened, and we had a tyrant that basically said, I'm going to stack the court, and I will overthrow you with all of my new appointments. And
and to some extent, both sides have bought into that. I mean, if you think of, you know, what's the most consequential thing that's come out of the first 6 or 7 months of the Trump administration, it's been a judicial appointment, and, you know, with every expectation that, you know, from I guess from one side, you know, he's appointed to preserve the Constitution, but from, you know, for many people, if that's different from existing interpretations, then they see that as a form of activism.
Correct. Well, so that goes into, I guess, the this other line of thought that I have is if you look at the establishment back in the day, even the Republicans and the Democrats have kind of had the same group think, because even Coolidge called himself a progressive. Teddy Roosevelt, I believe, you know, gets the honors of being the first progressive
right.
president. And so today we're looking at a completely changing landscape in politics because Trump got elected because of the anti-establishment. And it is interesting because here's the oxymoron. He is reaching into, you know, appointments of the bench that are probably establishment thinkers because they're not going to be the anti-establishment. Where are the anti-establishment judges? You know, somebody said, as a matter of fact, there's an author in Georgia. His name's Mark Erbach, and I've had him on the show before. And he said, you know, GR, you should be the next Supreme Court justice because...
Well, you better get a law degree first.
I understand that. And I know
I had a professor once. He's a great guy, great student of the judiciary, but has, like me, a PhD rather than the JD. And so somebody pointed out, one of his friends pointed out that it's not required in the Constitution that you have a JD.
Right.
And he recommended my professor, Henry Abraham, as a possible appointee.
Uh-huh.
And then Henry wrote some things that were a little more conservative than this critic wanted, and so he took him off the list in his next edition.
Interesting. Yeah, so that is true. There are really no standards because back in the days of the Constitution, I think James Madison received an honorary J.D., but a lot of the framers I don't think had J.D.s. And
well, a lot of them, Jefferson's a good example. He read law under George Wythe, and it's uh-huh. probably not a better legal education he could have gotten, but he did. To my knowledge, he didn't have a formal law degree.
No, but he passed the bar for Virginia
right.
or whatever that standard was because he did yep. practice law in Virginia. And so I guess that's all you had to do back then. You didn't.
Patrick Henry earned his in about 6 weeks. same, you know, by just sitting at, you know, going to a judge and convincing him that he knew enough to be an attorney. And he was good at it.
He was a very convincing man.
Yes, he was.
But he, along his way, he picked up a lot of friends and foes. But
yes, he did.
Back to, and here we go, I'm going to circle back around. That
okay, he's trying to get me out of the rat hole.
Yes,
again,
we have all of these judges that are still part of the groupthink. And we do have this big movement, and I think you would concede or maybe acquiesce, or maybe you'd say, well, maybe. Because of your argumentative skills, but I think that the anti-establishment is growing, and I think that the sentiments amongst a lot of the flyover states is moving in that direction, that we've got to get out of this, you know, this living constitution. We've got to get back to the hard, fast constitution and document.
And unfortunately, I think it's a little bit different. I think we're polarizing. We have groups on each side that are farther to the right or left than they previously had been, and it's very hard to get much compromise between them. I mean, you know, when you get a Trump and you get a Hillary, or you know, you get a Bernie Sanders, I don't think you could get 34 or 35 states right now to agree on much of anything.
And bottom line, you need 38. 38
yes, exactly.
to actually make a change, but I say
that's
you
right.
only need 13 states to stand up and say you can't do that anymore because you don't have 38 states to do that. This energy stuff, you've got to stop that. This education stuff, shut it down. This healthcare, all of these things that you're doing that are outside the Constitution, if I get 13 states, then now I've got that that constitutional barrier that says we never amended the Constitution to give you these powers, and we're going to take these back. We're shutting these down. And so,
well, again, I, you can make that kind of assertion, but I don't know how you would enforce it. I mean, I don't know a court that would recognize the power of a state to conduct such an audit.
Well, this,
or to enforce such an audit.
Well, the Article 7 clearly states that it requires state buy-in, not court buy-in, for the Constitution to be valid.
Well, for the ratification of the Constitution.
And further, sure. and further ratification of anything to be constitutional requires 38 states. But it's
right.
the Constitution's pretty clear
50, yes.
that it left everything, and all the founding documents are pretty clear. It left everything to the states to determine what is to be constitutional or not. And so I know that the court's going to sniff this as, you know, we've got this real threat here that the states could step up and actually, undo a lot of the stuff that we've kind of allowed happen. And I get that. And I think it's really important because the worst thing that can happen to me is they discard the Constitution because they say, you know what, and I think that's what maybe I'm going down that path to forcing people to either stand up for the Constitution or it's going to be gone, because the next political expediency, urgency, whatever, for political purposes, they will discard the Constitution because they've done it before. And you know this, Professor, that FDR nationalized almost everything. Even Nixon price controlled everything. So we're coming up on a break, and I will... If you could hold on for one more segment, we
sure.
can try to wrap this up. And maybe next
okay,
time we'll
enough.
Do the 17th Amendment. All right, folks, please stay tuned. We will be right back with The Good Doctor.
Reclaiming the Republic is more than an educational radio show. My intent is to also work with you and local leadership to promote matters of the Constitution and self-governance. This way we can all promote constitutional awareness within our communities and with our elected officials and public leaders. If you love liberty and sovereignty and recognize the federal tyranny that is threatening our lives, then we are asking for your help. And here are a few ways you can help. Spread the word about this radio show, Reclaiming the Republic. It is the only radio show in the world asserting a constitutional solution to federal overreach. Download and share our podcast and content. Read, like, follow, and share our Mobiusstrip Press and Reclaiming the Republic pages on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter at Mobiusstrip News. Get informed about local groups in the area and get involved. Most importantly, become a constitutional warrior with your local leaders and demand that they begin applying constitutional tests to what they are doing and who they are supporting. Thank you.
All right. Thank you so much, Dr. Vile, for hanging on and being patient with me. I hope I'm a good student.
Absolutely.
So my biggest fear, and I think most people are recognizing this, that there's no stopping the overreach, and there's just no stopping. And it's happened historically that they've actually set aside the Constitution three times. I think the Civil War was one, where it was kind of set aside, the habeas corpus and those types of things. And during the World War, actually, I think even World War I and then World War II. And then once again, they set aside the Constitution with Nixon in price controls. And so my real big concern is that this next big disaster, they're going to say, you know what, we've been doing so good as a government. We don't need this thing anymore. We're going to do what's best for everybody. Don't worry about it. And I don't want that to happen. And you say,
well, I don't either, obviously.
Okay.
And, you know, that's one reason we have elections.
Yes.
And, you know, I think the original hope, I do think a lot of us, I think we tend to vote on, you know, what programs we like or dislike at the time, rather than, you know, the Bill of Rights particularly, when Jefferson wrote to Madison, you know, it wasn't in the original Constitution, and Jefferson hadn't been there, and he writes to Madison and basically says, you know, every people are entitled to a Bill of Rights.
Right.
And, you know, he was hoping they would be enforced in courts, but beyond that, he also thought that they would have an educative function, and that people, you know, would read the rights and say, well, you know, by golly, I have to go back to an earlier illustration, I have the right to worship God as I please, and that should include the right to educate my children in the values, you know, that I uphold. And you know, you've seen quite a bit of that, I think, in the homeschooling movement.
Yes.
Not always by conservative Christians either. I mean, you have groups all along the spectrum who think that, you know, the public schools have led to, you know, more conformity than is necessary, but also, you know, sometimes inadvertently or otherwise end up, you know, bringing forth values that are not necessarily consistent with those that would be taught at home.
Right. But you bring up a good point, because we're living in a time of social engineering, and that social engineering is coming from the state. And the state is
sure.
basically – and that's
and not only the state. You see, you know, you can't go into a grocery store without, you know, knowing that objects have been placed in certain places to make sure that you go buy them, and you're more likely to buy them than if they were not so placed.
Right, and that lends to what they now are identifying as the deep state or the dark state, where because they point to the intelligence communities and these mind or think tanks that are, you know, trying to form policies and form programs to get us to behave better. It's almost like, and I've talked about this on my show before, about Thanksgiving and about how we've been manipulated with Christmas. And, it, you know, when they started the mass manipulation of Christmas here in this nation, and what we end up have today is, you know, nothing from any heritage, that I'm going, well, this is just the power, and they understand the power of manipulation.
Sure.
And so with the fact that we do have the state in control of education, you know, more and more people are recognizing that they're not going to want to let go. And the more they get down this path, they're not going to want to lose this power even more and more. And so, especially when they're so much closer to their goal.
I think that, you know, there's something of a pendulum here in many of these areas. You know, you see it in the environmental regulation. You see it in education, maybe you see it in disaster relief of, you know, what is the responsibility of, you know, the locals. I think one of the most heartening things actually about the Hurricane Harvey is to see, you know, and I hope it's not lost in the wash, but to see how many private volunteers came out and said, you know, we may not be able to wait for help from Washington or Austin. You know, we got to rescue people right now.
Sure.
And that, you know, that's sort of the essence of the American way.
Sure. I know that local churches, local community leaders,
yes.
even politicians, because I've seen here in the state of Washington a call to, you know, from the political parties to say, here's how you can help, do this. And so a lot of them are, you know, pointing to the Red Cross. And I know that
Yeah,
I know there's other people that say don't give the Red Cross because very little of the dollars goes to the real relief and so forth. But sometimes the Red Cross puts that aside and says, okay, we're going to dedicate everything that is contributed in this fund out to the help of the people instead of the infrastructure and so forth.
Right.
But and bottom line, it does cost money to create an organization like the Red Cross, because when I served in the Marine Corps, the Red Cross provided an integral service in letting you know that you had a baby born back in the 70s.
Sure.
And, you know, those things, there was no other mechanism for that but the Red Cross. But
right.
Anyway.
Yeah, I think it's the first public-private sort of partnership of its type in the United States.
Right.
And, of course, you know, there are many others since then, but it was... It actually had sort of semi-government, probably not status, but authorization when it was created.
Right. Back to your point of the polarization, though, because the establishment is, people are, I think, on the conservative side have left or are leaving and abandoning the conservative establishment and saying, you know what, if you're not focusing back on the Constitution and you're not moving us in that direction, then we're not supporting you anymore. And that's what we're seeing in elections. And you're absolutely right, because there's absolute communists out here now that are saying, we want communism, we're going to revolt, and we've got guns now, and we're going to fight this out to the death. Now, I understand that that's a small outlier group of communists that are willing to go down that path. And then there's, you know, you start moving back towards the center. I would just really hope, and I hate to say this, but sometimes it takes a movement like those crazy nut job communists to actually go out and kill and afflict the type of harm and, you know, casualties to get people to wake up, like a 9/11, and get people to wake up and go, are we really at that brink? We need to start shifting away from that. And it kind
of... I guess the one caution I would give is, you know, I'm also an alumnus of UVA, and, you know, when I saw the demonstrations there on campus, I was asked actually on a TV show a day or two later, you know, well, you know, there are thousands and thousands of neo-Nazis out there. I don't think so. I mean, maybe there are in the whole country, but, you know, you can get 250 people from any political stripe probably to show up anywhere. And sometimes I think, I mean, the I'm not just talking, I mean, yes, there's that kind of polarization, but even among, you know, liberals and conservatives, Democrats and Republicans, we seem to have developed a system where the personal interactions that they used to have are much weaker than they used to be, and that there's both sides are sort of demonizing one another. And
right.
I wish we could move. You know, we've had other periods in our history, including our Washington, you know, the Adams administration, where this has happened before.
Right.
But I hope we're not permanently stuck there.
But to be clear, the neo-Nazis is a left organization fighting another left organization of Black Lives Matter or whomever, because Nazism is not a individual liberty, individual sovereignty concept.
Absolutely
so,
not. I mean, yes.
So I have this, I have 2 minutes left, and
okay.
I'd like to basically say, because I know you love the Constitution, you've written a lot about it, and I know we're probably on 99% common ground when it comes to wanting to save and, you know, getting back towards, you know, the framers' intents and so forth.
Sure.
What would it take? Would it take a disaster, or would it literally take the losing of the Constitution for the recognizing of our electorate and the people to finally stand up and say, we absolutely do not want that discarded? Because the state is getting so powerful and so technical that they will be able, when they make that decision that they want to do that, they will have all sorts of things in their favor, unlike back in Washington's day where muskets were equal. What would you think
right.
it'll take? We got 1 minute left.
Well, I mean, education is, you know, I'm a university professor, so I have to believe in that. I really believe in building community. You know, I believe churches, I believe, you know, social organizations, all of these are critical. You know, I believe it's important, you know, how we raise our families and what values we try to instill there. And I don't care how much control a kid has, how long they're in school, they're going to get their primary message from their parents. And I think, you know, the founders really took the notion of what they call civic republicanism very seriously, that, you know, we were trained, yes, we would look out for our own security, but we would also be trained to look out for the interest of others. And, you know, any groups, you know, the real heroes of our society may be the grandparents who are raising children because their kids are on crack, and, you know, people that are stepping in the gap and, you know, where they are.
Right. So I will just inject this. The difference between everything that you said then and now is leadership. And what we really need is smart, educated leadership to understand those founding principles. Thank you so much for coming on, Doctor. And I will hopefully have you back on, if you're willing to, in the near future. Thank you again. Well, as you can tell, we definitely need to get the good doctor back on and have another heart-to-heart talk regarding his sentiments, because things have changed in the past several months. And I think that with the perspective that the electorate is literally in the process of changing from almost an even keel to a dominant on the progressive side, with the useful idiots coming out of the indoctrination center, there is no doubt in my mind that we have the exigencies at hand in literally trying to
save this republic. I know the good doctor loves the Constitution, and who knows, he may actually be able to have the optimism that I have that when things actually shift and that the federal government is no longer the nefarious pusher of indoctrination in the education system, he may see the merit in actually shifting to the states and actually becoming a dominant provider of education regarding the Constitution. I will tell you, as you know, I am G.R. Mobley. I am Reclaiming the Republic, and I need your help. So God bless, and we'll be back.
Are you a patriotic proprietor of a business that is looking to get exposure on a fast-growing program? How would you like to get exposure on the only program on the air that provides an actual constitutional solution to all the federal government overreach and encroachments? If you understand the importance of educating the electorate, we would love to work with you in growing your business and revenues while you support the airing of our content on this station. Your support goes to growing the reach of this show and does not pay for elaborate salaries or highfalutin lifestyles. The show is growing fast, and we're also planning on airing the content about Republic Review on a video medium soon. If you'd like to be a part of history and the growth of the most relevant and result-oriented show on the air anywhere in the world, then just email me at info@reclaimingtherepublic.org so you can lock in exceptional pricing and great advertising opportunities.